Good morning. So last time we finished up talking about assembly, talked about activation records, this notion that what we're putting on the stack for a function call, we can call that whole collection of things an activation record for the function. We talked about a few things we didn't talk about as far as just normal assembly instructions you might see reading assembly. One notion was that comp wasn't the only instruction that compared things. In fact, most of the arithmetic instructions in x86 did this. And we have this extra dedicated comparison instruction called test, which did a bitwise AND, which you usually see used to compare a value to zero because it generates slightly shorter machine code than comping with zero. We also talked about frame pointers, which were an older way of managing stack allocations in a function, which gave us a way to easily skip to the beginning of the function call stack allocation and made it easier for things like debuggers to produce a stack trace because they could easily find from the frame pointer, the previous frame pointer, and also the return address, and thereby get a whole stack trace. We talked about buffer overflows, so this notion that, well, because we're using our stack both to store actual data and stuff that's related to machine code, like return addresses, this control information, that if we have some mistake in how we manage our data and go out of bounds of an array or make some other sort of pointer mistake, that this can actually result in us executing the wrong code. And while, you know, if we do this by accident, usually trying to execute the wrong code is going to be a seg fault, like because we put something in place of the return address, and that something, you know, if we choose randomly, is going to be invalid. You know, sometimes it won't be, especially if someone malicious is choosing what that is. Then we moved on to talking a bit about C++. And we started by reviewing topics that you're supposed to remember with C++ with an eye to, well, now that we know what the assembly looks like, how are these really implemented? So we talked a bunch about pointers and references, which we learned in assembly really are, you know, the same thing, just the syntax is different. That when we're passing them to a function, we're passing an address, that's the same thing in assembly. When we're storing them as a temporary, that's either an address on the stack or an address in a register, that's really the same thing. And when we're allocating space for them, we're just allocating space on the stack and so on. So these are all things which were really the same when we looked at the assembly view. It hopefully gives you an idea of why you might want to care about what the assembly looks like, even if you aren't expecting to ever write anymore once you finish maybe the next week's lab. And we started talking about some other features of C++, which are going to come up on next week's lab that, you know, would be nice for you to see. And we're going to try to talk about, well, now that we know what assembly looks like, how do we implement these features of C++? And one of those was inheritance. So I gave this example where we have this name class, which stores a string name, has a setter, presumably, and has a print function. Presumably, if I weren't trying to save space in the slide, I'd also have a getter. And we have this type contact, which inherited from that. So a contact has a name and an address. So we override the print function. And we also add this address member. And we have this slightly different syntax than what you were used to in Java. We have this colon and a public name to inherit from name instead of extends name. And to call the parents function, we used the full name of the method, including the class name, rather than a super syntax. And we'll see a reason why C++ didn't choose to use super colon colon or super dot something in a second. We're never really going to explain why there's public here, so at least not formally. So there's other types of inheritance which are protected or private, which essentially you should never use and you will almost never see used, but they exist. That's why there's the keyword public. is to not use one of those. And the default is private, just like in a class, the default for member variables and functions is private. Okay. So we have this class. How do we use it? Well, it works the same any other class. We create an instance of it. And just like in Java, since we did have inheritance, it inherits the methods of the superclass. So it has a set name method, even though we didn't define that here, because we said it inherits name. So it has all of names methods, and print will in fact print out the name and the address, because it will call the superclass's print and then print out the address. So this is an example which is pretty uninteresting as far as inheritance is concerned. We aren't taking advantage of inheritance, really. We're just saving some code and writing the method. We could have done this by just adding a name and a name method to this class. Their inheritance is just sort of a shorthand to avoid writing some members and methods. But one of the other things we, you know, like to do with inheritance is use one thing as another. And we can do that here. We can have a contact C, and we can make a reference to it that's a reference to a name, because it's also a name. Or a pointer to it that's a pointer to a name, because it's also a name. And we can call that. And we can use, say, the set name method on that, and that will, in fact, change C. Yes?
Does that mean that the subclass can't be bigger in memory than the superclass?
The question is, does that mean the subclass can't be bigger in memory than the superclass? And the answer is no. So, but it's a good question. What does this look like in memory? So we have a pointer, and we learn that pointers just go to the same thing. So what are we doing? And the answer is that we lay out our subclass, typically such that the superclass appears first. So here is our contact C. We first have C.name, my name, and C.myAddress. After that. And if you remember, our name just had c.myName. And if we lay that out in the natural way, if we just look at the first part of this, that's going to be a name object. And that's why we can just take a pointer and interpret it as a name, because the first part of this object is the same. So we're essentially, we have these two, we have our superclass, and then the subclass stuff. And this together is our subclass object, which means that a pointer to the subclass, we can turn into a pointer to the superclass by just using the same address. So in a, just like references and pointers are the same in assembly, a pointer to the sub and superclass in this case are the same. Yes?
Okay, so we've got this contact, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then because we're using this contact as a name, we try to put this name into that array. Would it just usually be a contact? Would it cause an error to be trying to use something bigger than the space allocated for it?
Okay, so the question is, what's going to happen if I do something like name n 100 and then do n 15 equals c? So if you remember how the assignment operator works, C++, that this is going to try to call n.15.operator equals fc. So what is, so if you implemented that by hand, what would you do in that operator equals? So first of all, would one exist? So what would the prototype of our operator equals be? We'd have operator equals.
It would have to be whatever the type of the array is.
So this is n15, which is a name. So our conventional operator equals for a normal assignment is we take a reference to the same type. Okay. So the first question is, can we assign C to that? Can we use C as an argument to that? And the answer is going to be yes, because we can take C and use it as a reference to a name.
Okay.
So then we're going to call that operator equals. And what that operator equals probably will do, so either the default one or one we write, is that it's going to do my name equals n dot my name. Yeah, so it will just copy over the name.
Okay.
And indeed, this is not intuitive if you're used to Java. And you have, and the thing which I think is most tricky, which causes this to happen, is that our array is not an array of references. And in Java, all your arrays of objects of non-primitive types are really arrays of references. And if we have an array of pointers, well, we can do N15, it becomes a pointer to C, and that works just as we expect. But that's the sort of thing you actually have in Java. That's not what declaring a normal array in C++ will do, and the same thing is going to be true if we had a vector of names. And we'll see later that there's another problem we're kind of avoiding by doing this. Okay, so because we have this overlap, you know, pointers and references work the same as usual. We just can pretend it's the other type because we carefully laid it out so it has a copy of the base class type at the beginning. And that's where those members are stored. And this makes sense because we're just adding things when we set class. So we're just taking our original class and adding things to it. We're just going to add those to the end consistently in memory to make sure that, you know, just pointer stuff works. Okay. So that's a case of simple inheritance. So one thing we didn't get to is, what about constructor and destruction? So we remember we have constructors and destructors, and we sort of saw that we call print here, that, you know, we have to explicitly call the superclass, and if we didn't do that, presumably we never call the superclass's print function. So one question is, do constructors work the same way? And the answer shouldn't be yes, because let's say we need to initialize an array, who's going to do that? Especially if it's private. It's private, there's no way for the subclass to do that, so we better call the constructors, and similarly, we better call the destructors, because if we make a new array in our constructor of our base class, and that's into a private pointer, the only way that's ever going to be deleted is if we call the destructor too. So the rule in C++ is we construct the parent first, and then we construct the child. So we work from the base down and backwards. We always do our destruction in the reverse order of construction. This means most notably that if the child wants to access parts of the base class in its constructor, it can do that. Yes?
What if the child class has it? Separate a constructor, then does it have to be the same way, like when we construct a child?
So the question, is it about constructor arguments is what you're wondering about? Yes, so I will in fact show those next. So let's say we have arguments to the constructor. So if we want to pass arguments to the parent constructor, we need to do that with one of these initialization lists. So you may have been carefully avoiding ever writing initialization lists because you could have gotten away with it until now, but this is one case where you can't do that. So if you want to provide arguments to the base class's constructor, you initialize it like you would a member of the class in the initialization list. Initializer list, this colon list after the constructor call. And that is the only way that you can pass arguments to the parent constructor. And in a case like this, where the parent does not have a default constructor, you must do that, or else this code, or else your subclass won't compile. Like, even if you have an empty, a default constructor for the child, it won't compile. So here, we pass 100 to the child constructor, and the first thing which happens is we call the parent constructor. So when we don't have to write this explicitly, that's done for you, but that's the first thing which happens. So we call the parent constructor, in this case, with x plus 1. So we passed x equals 100 here. That turns into 101, and that's what gets passed to the parent, and it prints that value out. Then the child constructor runs with 100, and then we're in main, and then the destructors run in reverse order. So this is how we do arguments. Okay, so far, these are all features which look fairly familiar if you're used to Java. So there's one feature which gets a bit strange, and this is going to be multiple inheritance. So we'll talk about this a bit later. Well, this is in fact something that C++ supports, so it's kind of like having interfaces and base classes in Java. But we're going to talk about it later, because if you think about what we showed you earlier with this layout, if you try to do that for multiple inheritance, it kind of breaks down. Like, which base class do you put there? You have to choose, and you can't really. So we're going to have to, the compiler's going to have to do much trickier things to handle the case of multiple inheritance than anything I've shown you. Like, this trick does not work for multiple inheritance. I have to choose to put, you know, name first or serializable first. I can't put both of them in the same place because they have different stuff. So we'll talk about that in a second. So that's one thing which is going to work differently than in Java because of how we implement it. So another thing that is different than in Java is that, well, there's something you expect it to work that doesn't. So let's consider this code. So here I have a function which returns a pointer to the type parent, and it makes a new child. So that makes sense. Looks like we have something to figure out what type of subclass of parent to get, and we return a child just statically, and we call the print method on it, and there's an implementation of the parent, which says I'm parent print, and we just child, which says child print. We call that, and then we delete the thing so we don't leak any memory. And if you run this, the output is parent print, even though we have a new child object. Now, why isn't this code being called? And this is something that in Java you would say, that definitely shouldn't happen. But in C++, this is what the compiler must do. So C++ defaults to something called static dispatch. And static dispatch means that we're calling a method, we're choosing what method to call when we have multiple choices based on the compile time types. And in this case, our compile time type is we have a pointer to parent. So we're saying, okay, parent is the type. I'm gonna look up print in parent, and that's what I'm gonna call. So when we're generating assembly here, the compiler has somewhere in here call, parent print, except it's using the mangled name of parent print. And what we expect it to happen is what's known as dynamic dispatch, where we call based on the runtime type. And the assembly for that is more complicated. We can't just put a call instruction in there. We have to somehow figure out which print method are we calling. And that's more complicated than assembly. And because that's more complicated than assembly, C++ doesn't default to that. So one part of C++'s design philosophy is this notion of not doing things which are slower, except if absolutely necessary. So they've decided that unless you ask for it, they're not going to do this slower thing of using the runtime type. They're going to assume the compile time type is good enough. And there's going to be a way to ask for it, which we will show you in a second. But this is what happens by default. So any questions about this? Okay, so another case where C++ defaults to static dispatch, which is considerably more insidious than this. So here, when this happens, you're probably going to figure it out when you debug. It's probably not going to like crash your program. It's just going to make it do something weird. There's another case, which is for calling destructors. So here, we have the same situation, but we just delete our object P. And if you run this, we have this print in our child, which prints tilde child. But our output most likely is going to be parent child, so we call both of the constructors. And then we only call the parent's destructor. And this is another example of that static dispatch rule, that when our compiler generated the call to delete, it did call parent in assembly, except using the mangled name, rather than doing something to look up which destructor do I call to implement the delete operator. And I have the output listed as probably because you're actually not even guaranteed for this to work. The compiler can do something broken instead. We'll talk about that in a second when we talk about what the fix for this is. So this is an static dispatch. So this doesn't do what you expect from Java, but C++ defaults to it because it assumes that you don't want it to spend any extra time if you don't need it. And if you can promise that whenever I'm using a parent object to delete or call print, that I really have a parent object and not some subclass, then that's fine. But if you can't, you should ask for dynamic dispatch. And the way you do that is with a keyword called virtual. We'll see in a bit where that name comes from. And this is how you ask for dynamic dispatch. And virtual, you're going to use on a method by method basis. So you can request for each method, should I use dynamic dispatch for it. And if you use virtual, this means that the compiler, when it generates code to call that method, is not going to just call parent whatever. It's going to look up the function to call based on the particular object you have, which means there needs to be some extra information in the object to make that work. And we'll talk about the most common form for that extra information. So, yes?
Are we doing that when we define the method or when you use it?
When you define the method.
Okay.
So this is the minimal addition here, where I just added virtual to the parent class. So this means when I call parent print, it's actually going to look up what print function to call based on the actual object type. I didn't put it for child, and that means that child still uses child print, if I call that on a child object, still uses static dispatch. So if I have a pointer to child and I call print, it's going to call child print, even if there's another subchild, grandchild class. It's not going to do that. If I wanted that to happen, I need to make child print virtual too. Yes? So the question is, how would you apply this to destructors if you're not writing them yourselves? You're going to have to write them yourselves. You can make them be empty, but you have to write them yourselves. And if you look at real C++ code, you will very commonly see empty virtual destructors for this reason. They aren't really empty, they're just making sure the correct destructor gets called. So if we declare this as virtual, then what happens is what we expect from coding in Java, that we actually call child print because we have a child object. And if we declare the parent's destructor as virtual, what actually happens is we call the child's destructor, even though because we have a parent object, we look up the destructor, we say it says virtual, so we figure out the real destructor based on the actual runtime type. Okay, so a bit about virtual destructors. So obviously there's a problem with not having virtual destructors if you think your subclasses are going to add things that need the destructor to like delete something. But in fact, you're going to get in trouble more often if you don't have a virtual destructor. So the rule in C++ is that you must have a virtual destructor if you call delete on a base class pointer, but you actually have a subclass. No matter what, even if there's nothing for the destructors to do. And probably the way to think about why this rule exists is the compiler might use the destructor to know how much memory to free. So there might be the code you don't write in the destructor might include like returning the size of the object. And if you don't have a virtual destructor, it's going to return the size of the base class, not the subclass, and delete won't free up the right amount of memory, and you'll leak memory, for example. That's one thing which could happen. The C++ standard, in its very formulaic language, says the behavior is undefined. So that means that the compiler can choose to do whatever it wants. It can like make your program segfault if it figures out a reason it wants to do that. But the practical reason is that real implementations, including the ones on Linux, commonly use the destructor to figure out how big was the thing I just deleted. Okay, so we've seen the syntax for doing these dynamic dispatch. So what does this actually look like? So here I have a case where I have a virtual method foo. I've declared it virtual in both the parent and the child. I'm calling it from the parent with a parent pointer, but I have this get function which could return a parent or a child or perhaps even a grandchild or some subclass I don't know about. I'm calling foo. What does the assembly for main look like? How do I generate this call to foo? Because I definitely can't just figure out which one to call. You know, it could be the case that get like chooses a random number or asks for user input to figure out what type to return. And if I'm the compiler compiling this to 1.0 file, I don't even know what's in the get function. Like I don't know what type is being returned when I'm writing the assembly for this. So I need to be able to write assembly which works every time, even for subclasses I don't know about yet. So the typical strategy for this is that we're going to add some information to the base class. And that information is going to tell us where to find all the virtual functions. And this is something known as a vtable, or a virtual table, or a virtual function table. So the typical layout would be that the first thing in our object for a parent is what is called a vtable pointer. And that points to something which, if we have a parent object, has the address of parent foo and all the other virtual functions we might need to look up, and including presumably the destructor, which we've made virtual. And if we have a child, it has a pointer to child foo and all the other virtual functions we need to look up, including the destructor. And we carefully make sure that this vtable has the same layout for both the parent and the child, at least the first part of the same. So this means, you know, first, I read the vtable pointer from the object. And no matter which type of object I have, it's in the same place, because remember, we duplicate the layout of the base class and the subclass. We just have a pointer to a different thing, depending on the type. And then I use that to actually call a method based on an address inside there. And because these are laid out in the same way, depending on which type I have, I will call the appropriate method. I'll call parent foo or child foo. And you can see here that we paid two kinds of costs to support this dynamic dispatch. So one cost we paid is that we added this extra pointer to all our parent objects. So if we didn't have any virtual methods, the C++ compiler is not going to have this in your objects. Your objects just won't have that extra 8 bytes of space. And the other cost is that instead of being, two instructions, this move to set the argument and a call, we have three instructions, and the third one is considerably more complicated when we're calling the function. We're doing this indirect call instruction. So we've generated slightly slower assembly, but it does the right thing at least. It calls the function we expect it to call, not statically just the child one. And because our parent and child have the same layout, we didn't need to do anything different as far as passing this pointer to the function. We're just passing the address of P, and that's the same for the parent and the child. They can interpret the same address the same way. So any questions on vtables, how this dynamic dispatch is implemented? Okay, so one nit is that we didn't talk about how construction works. And this is a case where we need to do some special things with the virtual tables. And what C++ has decided to do is that we have the same rule that the parent is constructed first, then the child. And conceptually, it's as if the parent constructor, before anything happens, it sets the vtable for the parent, and the child constructor, before it does anything, sets the vtable for the child. Which means that in the parent constructor, if you call virtual methods, you'll call them on the parent. And in the child constructor, if you call them, you'll call them on the child. Which is sometimes not intuitive. The usual rule of thumb is that you probably shouldn't be calling virtual methods from constructors. But if you do so, this is what's going to happen. It's well-defined. But you probably, often not what you expect. And it makes sense because we don't want to ever call a child method before we call that constructor. Yes?
So is this just if the constructor is virtual, or if there are any virtual methods?
So the question is this just if the constructor is virtual? Constructors are not allowed to be virtual. Okay. We always use static dispatch to call constructor because we always have to know the real type we're constructing. In the code, it has to be written down. So the question is, does the vtable just include the virtual methods, or does it include all of them? Typically, it just includes the virtual ones, because if we included other ones, they would never be used. Okay. So one last little thing about virtual functions is that there's something that C++ calls pure virtual functions. And in Java, you would call these abstract functions. And the way you write this is with equals zero. Presumably, the syntax comes from the idea that you're setting the vtable entry to be a null pointer, conceptually. And this works pretty much like abstract does in Java. If you have any pure virtual method in a class, you cannot construct it. You can only construct subclasses of it, which define that method. And you know, if you have a class which only has pure virtual methods, that's pretty much like a Java interface. Okay, so that's on dynamic dispatch. So one topic I previewed earlier was multiple inheritance. And this creates many questions about how this works just for accessing members, for calling methods of the base classes, and for laying out our object in general, and of course with dynamic dispatch. So C++ supports two kinds of multiple inheritance. And this is an issue which comes up, unlike in Java, because when we have multiple inheritance in C++, we can inherit things which have data members. So in Java, you could only inherit method names, so that wasn't really very interesting. In C++, you can inherit data members, which means that it matters how many copies of those data members are there if you inherit a class multiple times. So we can have replicated parents. So in this case, I have a diagram where I have student-professor, which inherits from student and professor, which both inherit from person, and student inherits from GPListNode and professor inherits from GPListNode. And we're saying that GPListNode is going to be this base class which presumably like has a next pointer and a previous pointer, which we want to be separate for the list of students and professors, but we want to have this common person superclass which has like a single name member which is shared between the two. And we can do both of these in C++ at the same time. And in Java, this didn't come up because, well, when you have multiple inheritance, it always dealt with things which only had methods, so it didn't really make a difference which one you were doing. You always had a single implementation of those methods in the subclasses because you had, you know, interfaces overridden, and you can look at the most derived version of that, and you have one version you can call. But that doesn't work out that way in C++. Yes?
I'm not sure I understand the difference between the replicated and the shared. Like, I see it in the diagram, but what would that mean?
So what does this mean? So let's say GPListNode has a next and has a next. So that means that if I take a student object, this points to next points to A. If I convert this to a professor object, next points to some B. So there's two separate nexts, depending on whether I'm interpreting this as a student or a professor object. So in particular, if student has a, say, get next student method, I will presumably it will use this next pointer. And if I have a get next professor, it will use this one. And that's because the student's class, I'm looking, when I call that method, it's looking at its parent. And the professor class, when I call that method, is looking at its parent.
Okay, so if they have two different parents, those aren't instantiated objects, are they?
So the question is, the two GPListNodes, those aren't instantiated objects, they're part of one object. So our one object, somehow, is going to have a person, a list node for student, a list node for parent, for professor, and a student, and a professor, and a student professor. It's going to have all of them. All those pieces are part of this one object.
How would you create the GP list node scenario separately from the person scenario? Like, what's the difference in how you declare?
So there's different syntax for when you declare the base classes. So there's a use of the keyword virtual, we'll see in a bit.
So we haven't learned how to...
Yeah, we haven't learned how to declare these two separate cases. And I haven't even told you what the default is. Yeah. Yes, you don't know how to declare these two cases. So let's first of all talk about the default, which is the replicated case. You probably didn't expect that. That seems like the less useful one. But that is the default. So here I have C, which inherits from A, and B, with both have inherit from parent. And if I do my base classes in the straightforward way, I get two copies of parent. So this means if I declare my C and I make a reference to it that's of type A, and I access the value in the parent, and I make a reference to it that's type B, and I access the value in the parent, they are two different values. That can be changed and accessed separately. Changing one doesn't change the other. They're actually two independent values, which is almost certainly not what you expected, and also probably not what's useful. To get the shared case, we use the keyword virtual when we declare the base class. So here we have a single parent, and we have A and B from which C inherits. And in this place, now there is one value. So if I change it to 1, then change it to 2, and I print it out, they're both 2, because they're both the same thing. Similarly, if like I got a pointer to it, they'd be the same address. If I had a pointer to it here, I'd have two different addresses, which would presumably be close to each other because they're part of the same object. So that means that the diamond tree you showed here, this is sort of the syntax you'd use to declare that the inheritance to person is declared as virtual, the other ones are not. And maybe if you were planning ahead, you might declare the inheritance to professor and student as virtual, but that's not necessary because we don't use them as multiple base classes in this example. So this shared base class creates a whole bunch of issues about when do we call things. So one thing you might wonder is, how is the shared parent constructed? And the rule is that when you have a virtual parent, you get to call the constructor in the actual base class, the actual class that is initiated, not its superclasses. So here we have C, B, A, and parent, but I have to specify in C's constructor how the shared parent's constructor is called. That's how I specify what that is. It's not specified by A or B. If I omit it, this is an error. The error is you need to call the constructor. There's no default one. Yes?
Are you saying this code is going to cause an error?
This code will not cause an error. But if I omitted this, that would be an error. Like if I just didn't try to call the parent constructor in C, that would be an error even though it's called in A and B. Yeah?
So it's like instead of being tied to the parent through either the two parents, or to the grandparent through the two parent classes, it's like tied to the grandparent directly?
So the question, instead of being tied to the parent, it's kind of like it's tied directly. It's sort of on the side is the way you can think of it. And similarly, I guess, so this is a case where I have a default constructor. Here, I didn't specify which one to call in C, and it calls the default constructor rather than doing what A or B do.
Okay. So that way we don't have to choose which parent to use.
Yeah, so you don't get to choose, you have to do it explicitly. So that's sort of how construction works with these diamond inheritance case. So let's start talking about layout. And we'll start talking about the case where there's duplicate classes because this is the easiest to understand. And in order to make multiple inheritance with duplicate classes work, what we're going to do is we're going to lay out the objects so we have two copies of them, and we're just going to adjust pointers when we actually convert between types. So we have You know, here I have a function which gets the GP list node for a student professor, either on the student side or the professor side. And I'm doing this by explicitly converting my reference to a student reference or a professor reference, and then extracting the GP list node. And what this tells us is that our student professor object, we have a pointer to it here, has 8 bytes, which we are used for who knows what, and then has the student GP list node, and then much later has the professor GP list node. And the compiler to give us a pointer to the appropriate type is actually just adjusting that pointer. So when we get a pointer to the student GP list node, we get a pointer to the middle of the object, and when we get a pointer to the professor one, we get a pointer to later on in the object. So the compiler figures out what the layout is, and when we convert between pointer or reference types, it generates code to adjust that pointer or reference to point the appropriate part of the object. And that's how we deal with multiple inheritance. For the simple case, we can just know what the layout of the object is, of the particular class, and adjust to get to the point where that base class is. So we have 2 base classes, and we just know relatively where they are in our student professor object, or the student part of the student professor object, or the professor part of this of an object. Now, this doesn't work when we have a shared base class, because there better only be one copy. So what's happening here is presumably that this whole thing is a student object that has all the fields of student, and this whole thing down here is a professor object that has all the fields of professor. That means when we have a pointer to a student, we can find the GP list node by looking in there. But if we have a pointer to the student, then we want to find person, it better be the same thing we find if we had a pointer to a professor. And we know in the student professor object, it can't be in both parts. It has to be at some other offset, which is different than if we had an instance of either the student class or the professor class. It has to be at a different offset. So this doesn't work for virtual inheritance, where we have to implement that diamond pattern, but for duplicated inheritance, the compiler just knows what the layout is and generates this code to offset. And since we'll review this next time, but the brief preview of how that works to make those be equal is that we'll use the vtable to store the information about what's the offset. Is that in addition to having pointers to functions, we'll have here's how you find the person object for this type. And we'll talk more about what the layout looks like next time.